Welcome to Understory, Western Australia's only environmental radio show. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today we'll cover both history and up-to-the-minute current affairs. We delve back into the impressions of the environment had by the first white settlers to Western Australia when I talk with historian Jane Davis, and then keep things contemporary by talking to Piers Versteegen about the state of the Swan River. In case you didn't know it, we have a state reference library here in Perth, and on the top floor of this library sits the Batty Library, the largest repository of books on the state's history. The Batty Library grants fellowships to historians working on the state's history, and the current Batty Fellow is a woman by the name of Jane Davis. Jane's the author of a PhD thesis on belonging in southwestern Australia, particularly the experience of belonging or not belonging, as the case may be, had by the early white settlers to the state. I started my conversation with Jane by asking her for a bit of context on white settlement in Perth. The full version of this interview is available on the podcast version of the show.
Well, Western Australia, basically, the first white people that came here came for land. And in one word, basically, land. They were free settlers as opposed to the first white people that came to the eastern colonies.
So they weren't sweaty criminals like in Botany Bay?
No. They were middle to upper middle class. I mean, they were all... They came with their servants, many of them. They were middle to upper middle class men and women, families from England and Ireland mostly. They were typically sons maybe of ministers, priests. They had enough capital, they had enough money to get themselves organised and bring their families, many of them. But they weren't the aristocracy, they weren't the landed gentry. Those people wouldn't have been interested in leaving what they had. They had too much to leave.
But maybe they were pretenders to be gentry.
Some of them were pretenders to be gentry, yes. Some of them thought themselves quite high standing, in fact. And it's interesting, they strove to maintain that when they settled in the colony.
And so one of the first chapters of your PhD thesis on belonging in the southwest of Australia amongst the early settlers is about the settlers in the Upper Swan area.
Yes.
And so let's just focus on them for a minute. So they would have arrived and been given a ribbon-like strip of land along the Swan River. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, typically they were allocated land, and they were allocated land on the basis of how much capital they brought with them, which didn't always work. They didn't bring enough cash, and they brought a lot of inappropriate capital, a lot of inappropriate tools and machinery.
They didn't really know where they were coming.
No, they didn't know what to expect. Typically they were allocated strips of land, and they went up to the Upper Swan. So the area we now know as Guildford around there was one of the first areas. So people like George Fletcher Moore and Eliza Shaw settled there or took up land grants there in the 1830s.
Okay. And so George Fletcher Moore, for example, let's talk about him because he's left quite a few writings about his experience of arriving in Western Australia and his knowledge of the Noongar people. George Fletcher Moore, he was a bachelor, wasn't he?
He was. He came out with a couple of servants and he relied on these. But, yeah, he was came out on his own. He was a lawyer, came from Ireland, and there are various reasons why he didn't practice law in there. One reason is that, one suggested reason is he didn't have enough money. Yeah, so he got on the boat and out he came.
And was he one of the sad, dejected farmers sitting on the sandy soils of the Swan Coastal Plain, not making a living?
That's not my picture of him. He was an interesting, complex man with a wide range of interests. He loved his little farm. He writes about it with great affection. He talks with pride about the first watermelon, about his vines, about his trees, about his vegetables. And he also writes about his flowers. So he planted flowers and tended a flower garden, which is interesting for a number of reasons. He was also quite busy he had various positions in the colony. So although he had land and he had a house up in the Upper Swan, which initially he called the Hermitage, he later renamed it Millenden when he...
It was a lonely place.
He understood that was the Indigenous name for the area, so,
so
he renamed it.
That area just to the east of the Upper Swan is called Millenden
well,
for the Noongar people.
That was one of the names that they called it. Yeah. So he renamed his house Millenden, and he says in his diary he did that when he realised that that was one name that the Noongars called it.
So what was his response to the West Australian environment? Did he like it?
He was fascinated by it. He saw it through a variety of lenses, if you like, or, you know, there were a number of ways he viewed it. He was certainly interested in the productivity of the land. He had come to take up land, and it was important that it was productive. But he also viewed it from an aesthetic point of view, so he had quite an aesthetic response to it, and he found many parts of it quite beautiful. The settlers that came out were familiar with the idea and the concept of the picturesque, and they used the word picturesque a lot. But they also, as well as using the word, they described the land in using the language of the picturesque, which was a certain tradition with which they were very familiar.
Right, from paintings back in Europe.
Yeah, from paintings and way of viewing the landscape. Yeah,
and I suppose it probably was quite picturesque in the way that the Noongar people had burnt a lot of the undergrowth and left big tall trees and open pastures for the kangaroos.
Yes, and he commented on that. And they used the word parklands. It looked like parklands, some of the land. I mean, he was interested also, he was really interested in the botany of the place, the flora and the fauna. And some of his descriptions are very, very accurate. He was incredibly knowledgeable. So as well as viewing it from a sort of productive utilitarian point of view and an aesthetic point of view, he also viewed it with a scientific eye. And that comes through very clearly in his writings.
But George Fletcher Moore, I mean, he was an interesting man and you know, he did probe deeply into the Noongar culture in his writings. He's probably not typical of the early white arrivals in Western Australia, is he, in that sense?
Yes and no. I mean, he wrote much more, perhaps, than the others. And when people write a lot, perhaps you get a different perspective. Perhaps it's a pity they didn't all write as much. He was unique in that he was more observant. He had more time, perhaps, because he didn't have a family for many years. It wasn't until 1846 or something that he married. He thought a lot about things, but there were others that also viewed the land from a variety of perspectives, for example, and appreciated it and had quite extensive botanical knowledge, surprisingly so.
You say, although Moore knew quite a lot about Noongar culture, you say that this didn't actually help him feel a sense of belonging in Western Australia. What's your evidence for that?
Although he did understand or try to understand Noongar culture, his views, his attitudes towards them were quite contradictory, and he wrestled with this. He likened, on the positive side, for instance, he likened their own fables and stories and explaining the world to his own cultures, say the Roman myths and legends, fables. So he could see the similarities. But he, as well as making friends with them and at times writing with quite empathy for them, he also wrote some quite harsh things about them. And in the end, his personal, because he wrote quite differently about them sometimes in his personal diary and publicly, he was kind of perhaps torn between what he felt for them on a personal level and the ones he befriended, and his role as a land taker, as a prominent member of this society, which in general terms was quite opposed to the Aboriginal people and treated them in the end very fairly. And on the one hand, they knew that they'd taken the Aboriginal people's lands. On the other hand, they didn't do anything about it, and in the end it made very little difference to their own sense of belonging and how they, I suppose, how they called it home.
It's interesting, because I would have thought that learning about all of these ways in which the Aboriginal people drew sustenance from the land, what plants they ate, you know, where they were in winter, where they were in summer, what their seasonal movements were, would actually link you more to the land, make you feel more like it's possible for humans to belong here. It does to me anyway, but You said in so much to George Fletcher Moore. I wonder if that was to do with his swallowing this 18th century idea that, civilization is the peak of human achievement in Western Europe and these guys were just ignoble savages.
Yeah, possibly. And other people writing about these ideas have found that knowledge of Indigenous people has increased their sense of belonging. And that does make sense on one level. But from my reading of George Fletcher Moore, let's say, his journal, his writing, his diary, the differences in culture perhaps were too great. In the end, yes, they were people, they were interesting, but they were savages and they would never attain the same level of civilization as in George Fletcher Moore's eyes.
Part of his idea of civilization was growing rose bushes, wasn't it? He had a that's just something I noticed that seems to have abided in West Australian culture. In front gardens around Perth, you can see rose bushes growing to this day.
Yeah, you can. And I mean, planting familiar plants from their home back in Ireland or England was quite a common way for the settlers to make them feel more comfortable in their environment. That was one way, by creating gardens and making meaning. So I guess turning the spaces into places in ways that were meaningful to them. Having said that, they did also, some of them, plant Indigenous flora.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
Not George Fletcher Moore, but for instance, Wollaston in the down in the Australind area, John Ramsden Wollaston. He transplanted various native plants and put them into his own garden.
Moving on with the general gist of your argument in your PhD thesis, you seem to be saying that we can't say the early settlers didn't like Western Australia and the land here. We can't say that they did. It was a varied and complex reaction that were different among each individual. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes and no. It was very complicated responses. Many of their initial responses were disappointment when they came to the Swan River Colony, and that's been well documented, the disappointment with the land. But over time, some of them, not all of them, but over time, some of them did come to feel great affection for the place. Sometimes their affection for place was based on community in a sense of belonging in terms of connections they made with people, not necessarily the land. And that was a theme that kind of emerged from my research and was consistent across most of the regions. And again, not for everybody, but for some of them. So, I mean, it's difficult to make generalisations, but in the end you have to make some to make sense of what you read and what you write.
But of course it's true that you can't just get a sense of belonging simply from a relationship with the natural environment. I think a sense of community amongst your fellow humans helps quite a lot as well.
Yeah. And perhaps in terms of broad general ideas of place and belonging, maybe that has been overlooked when we're talking about people fitting into place. And I guess the land in Australian writing does play such a huge part, and film and writing poetry. This Australian land really stands out.
Did you find that towards the end of the period you were studying, people stopped referring to England as home?
Sometimes, but what was more common was they kept referring to England as home, but they also started talking about the place where they lived in Western Australia as home. So home is a, how many letters? Four letters, but it's a huge concept, and many people have written about it in much more detail than I have. But they, in the one letter or the one diary entry, they might use the word home to refer to their place of origin, so Ireland perhaps or England, maybe to their specific house where they're actually living at the moment, whether it was the Swan Valley or Kalgoorlie, and also perhaps more generally to the area, so to Western Australia. And we have the idea and it's been written about a lot, that home, they wrote letters home, and home was always their place of origin. And while it may have remained obviously a special place for them, they used the word home a lot to refer to their new home. And they made comments like, my adopted country. And I mean, George Fletcher Moore, getting back to him, he really was wrestling with the idea of home. And he said things like, home, what a strange word this is. Where is my home now? So he really asked himself this question and wondered about it, because he still felt ties to Ireland, not unexpectedly, but he, as the years went on, he felt increasingly kind of located and a sense of belonging for his house that he called Millenden in the Upper Swan.
And just finally, a quote from Eliza Shaw sprung up at me out of your thesis. And in the 1870s, the financial situation of the property she had in the Upper Swan wasn't so good, and she was forced to sell it. And in her diary, she wrote, oh, what a trial it will be to see it pass away, and how am I to write that poor dear Belvoir is advertised for sale? She says, when I look towards dear old Belvoir and days gone by and the joys and sorrows it has seen us all through, my poor heart is very sad. So I thought that was interesting in the sense that she was actually squatting on Noongar hunting territory. And yet that doesn't enter into any of what she writes.
No, that's right. And, of course, she didn't see it that way.
No.
And few of them did in the end, even though, on the one hand, as we've said, they acknowledged and they knew in an objective sense. But regardless of that, they went on anyway and made their homes and built up fences and invaded the Noongar territory. She writes as though the property's been in her family for generations, like 400 or 500 years. But in fact, it was only 46 years. But her anguish is real, and I don't think we can underestimate it or, I guess, gloss over it, even though we perhaps don't see it that way. She genuinely had this feeling for the land and affection and attachment. It's where she had brought up her family. She had buried children. She'd watched other children marry. She'd become a grandmother. She had a long life in Western Australia. And, ultimately, she did see it as home.
And on that note, I think we'll have to finish. But today, probably the people who feel most at home there are peeps at a music festival in the Belvoir Amphitheatre. So it's a strange turn of events where
yes.
Belvoir's gone today.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, thanks very much, Jane Davis. Just last week we had Piers Verstegen on RTR telling us about some recently proposed changes to the Environmental Protection Act. Stuff that sounds pretty boring, but turns out to be quite significant. The following interview is actually about the current state of the Swan River's health. However, before I get into that subject, I wanted to ask Piers to further flesh out what some of these legislative changes would really mean for nature in WA.
Well, the Barnett government at the moment are pursuing an approvals reform agenda, they call it, which is really about making the whole environment much, much easier for industry to come in and undertake their development, whether it's a mining development or it's a housing development or whatever it is. They're trying to make the situation much easier for industry, and in doing that, what they're doing is removing a number of the provisions which are there to protect the environment. And the Environmental Protection Act has been in place for over 20 years now. And one of the key provisions of the Environmental Protection Act is allowing members of the community to comment on decisions that are made by the Environmental Protection Authority, and allowing members of the community to appeal decisions. And
So how can you do that if you're a member of the community? How could you appeal one of these decisions?
Well, you have appeal rights at the moment. Under the Environmental Protection Act, you can lodge an appeal with someone called the Appeals Convener, who then has to have a look at your appeal and judge it on its merits, and then go back to the minister and say, well, we've received these appeals, we believe that this is a significant issue, we should change the decision that the Environmental Protection Authority have made, or we should put some more controls on this development because we don't believe that that there's enough controls in place to ensure that it does actually protect the environment. So as an individual at the moment, you have those rights. You have the rights to appeal those decisions. But this bill before Parliament is going to take those rights away. And really, it's going to mean that there'll be very little opportunity for members of the community to appeal decisions or to have input into decision-making where those decisions affect the environment. The government's doing this because they think it's going to speed up decision-making for industry and make it easier for industry to get their proposals through. But really, it's a significant erosion of transparency and accountability in the decision-making process, and it's taking away a right of members of the community to have a say in relation to decisions that will affect them.
Can you just give us an example of how this might actually operate in the real world?
Well, an example that's come up recently, which is a high-profile example, is a development down near Dunsborough, the Smiths Beach development. And people will be familiar with this. It's been responsible for some court proceedings against Brian Burke and others. But the whole reason why that issue was raised to the attention of the CCC and to the ministers was because the Conservation Council and other members of the community appealed the decision that was made at the time to allow the development to go ahead in Smiths Beach. And
so,
when they appealed that decision, that led to some investigations into how the decision was made.
Just to remind everybody, the Smiths Beach development proposal was to build a large hotel or series of cottage-style accommodation and, I suppose, clear a lot of native vegetation.
Yeah, it was to build two large hotels and a lot of residential houses down on a beach, which is it's basically at the moment it's a pristine beach. You know, it's basically a wilderness beach where people go surfing and go recreationally, but no one's living there. So they wanted to build these hotels there, and the community really were up in arms about that, as you can imagine. They didn't want this development to go ahead. And so they appealed that, and the Conservation Council appealed that decision, and that has now resulted in a process whereby the Minister's made a new decision to say, well, this can only go ahead in a very much scaled-back way, and that they've scaled that back to about half of what the original development proposal was going to be, to take into account the fact that there's very high environmental values in that area, that there's native vegetation that is, as I say, a very high value, and we can't afford to continue just clearing the native vegetation and building hotels on our pristine coastline.
So if the appeal rights were removed from the Environmental Protection Act,
as they're proposing, where appeal rights were used and community appealed the decision and then it resulted in a change of the decision, what the government's now doing is saying that they're going to remove those appeal rights, and they have a bill before Parliament to amend the Environmental Protection Act to take away those appeal rights. So in the future, if the Smiths Beach development was to come back again in its original form, there wouldn't be any opportunity for the community to appeal that development, and as a consequence, it may get through as it was originally intended or wanted by the developer without the community having a right to say anything about that.
So you could phrase the changes in terms of streamlining environmental destruction, possibly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably a good way to put it. And certainly members of the community and the Conservation Council hold very dearly the right to be able to have a say in relation to environmental decisions, as you can imagine. So for the government to just remove those rights by amending that act is really something that we're opposing very vigorously. But not many people know about this because it's not something that's been reported in the mainstream media. So it's good to see that RTR is picking up on this issue. It's sort of a bit of a complex and technical issue in a way. People think, well, I don't even know that I had those appeal rights. But if you had someone wanting to put a nuclear power station in their backyard next to your house, for example, you'd pretty soon find out what the options were to try and stop that. And if there weren't any appeal rights to try and prevent a decision like that from going ahead, people are going to be put into a pretty difficult situation where they can't really do anything to prevent these sorts of developments, which they know are dangerous for their own health in many cases and very damaging for the environment.
And in other news, not too long ago, the Liberal government's been cozying up to industry in another way, haven't they, in relation to fertiliser use. What's going on with the Swan River's health at the moment?
Well, we're very concerned about the health of the Swan River. And again, not many people know, but at present we actually have to artificially pump it with oxygen. And the Swan River Trust, that's the state government department responsible for the Swan River and the health of the Swan River, is having to spend a lot of money artificially pumping oxygen into the river just to keep it alive and to stop a lot of fish from dying. Now, the reason for that is because
it's like a patient on life support, isn't it?
A pollution problem in the river at the moment, which comes from fertilisers. And the Swan River Trust recently released a report saying that we need to reduce fertiliser input into the river by at least 50%. So we need to at least halve the amount of fertiliser pollution going into the river if it's going to continue to be a viable, healthy ecosystem into the future. Now, the previous government had a proposal to do that, and what they were saying was that we should put the responsibility for this pollution back on the fertiliser industry, and they should be forced to make products that don't pollute the environment, that still allow farmers to grow their crops and still allow gardeners to grow their roses or their lawn, but don't pollute the river. And
is that possible? Can you make
those
fertilisers?
Well, it is possible because you can produce slow-release fertiliser products, and those of us who know about gardening will know that you can either have a fertiliser that's slow-release, it releases its nutrients gradually over time, or you can have one which is highly water-soluble that on our Swan Coastal Plain, really a lot of the nutrients from the highly water-soluble fertilisers just end up straight in the groundwater because they get dissolved when you irrigate your lawn, or they get dissolved when the rain hits your pasture, and they fall straight through the soil profile, straight into the water table, and then they're carried through the water table into the rivers and wetlands. So we know that there are alternative products which can deliver just as good outcomes in terms of farm crops and just as good outcomes in people's gardens for plant growth, but these alternative products don't pollute the environment. And what the previous government said was that they would phase out the use of the polluting products in the Swan Coastal Plain, and that would eventually lead to a massive reduction in the amount of nutrient pollution that's entering the Swan River. Of course, there is still a huge bank of this nutrient in the groundwater itself, and that will take a long time to flush through. But really, the main thing we've got to do is stop this problem at source. There's no point trying to construct wetlands and things at the end of the drains that enter the Swan River. That will have a marginal effect, but really we need to stop the pollution at source by making the fertiliser industry produce these alternative products and mandating that they can only be used in the Swan Coastal Plain. But unfortunately, the state government now have gone back on that, and they've said, no, we're not going to continue with that fertiliser action plan. And instead, they've gone with a voluntary approach where the fertiliser industry employs their own consultants to go around and tell farmers how much fertiliser they should be using. So you can imagine that this has got some conflicts of interest associated with it. We don't think that it's going to work. We know that these approaches have been trialled in the past and haven't worked. And really we think that the Swan River is reaching a major problem whereby the whole ecosystem is going to collapse within the next 5 or 10 years if something serious is not done about it.
So basically we're on the brink of saving the Swan, and then the current state government scrapped the fertiliser action plan and things aren't looking so rosy anymore.
Well, that's exactly right, and unfortunately, at the moment, it looks like we're going to be having to continue pumping artificial oxygen into the river and continue doing more of that if we're not going to see major fish deaths and major algal blooms in the Swan River every summer. That's not really a sustainable solution, and what we need to do is, as I say, we need to stop the pollution entering the system in the first place at its source, rather than think we can just continually pump oxygen into the river and keep it alive that way.
All right, well, thank you very much for our regular environmental update. Piers Versteegen, head of the Conservation Council of Western Australia. You've been listening to a podcast of RTR 92.1 FM in Perth, Western Australia. RTR is a subscription-run organisation, so please subscribe.